Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
At least 17 dead, with nearly 100 others missing in an Indonesian landslide, and a possible Mugabe successor. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. A landslide in a remote Indonesian village has risen in death toll from at least 8 to now at least 17 as rescuers pull more bodies from the mud and rubble. Nearly 100 people are still missing since the slide was triggered late Friday by torrential rains in the Jemblung village in central Java province. The mud has now swept away more than 100 homes with hundreds of people evacuated. Cameroon says at least 600 Boko Haram fighters crossed Lake Chad and simultaneously attacked several villages in towns. During the fighting, officials say 25 insurgents were arrested, hundreds of others drowned in the lake. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Minister of Communication, Issa Chiruma Bakari, said fierce fighting erupted in the villages of Nguma, Sangmi, Ardebde, Dambore, and Swarem when government forces attempted to retake them from hundreds of suspected Boko Haram fighters reported to have ransacked the Cameroonian villages.
Our defense and security forces vigorously retaliated against this barbarous attack and forced the attackers to retreat.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe has two new vice presidents, including the man many see as the likely successor to 90-year-old President Robert Mugabe. Emmerson Mnangagwa has been sworn in as the country's first vice president during a ceremony Friday at Zimbabwe's State House. The second vice president, Felizikia Mofoko, also sworn in. This is VOA News. Militants in southern Afghanistan have shot and killed 12 workers clearing landmines in Helmand province on a day that saw the shooting also of a Supreme Court official in Kabul. Police say Afghan troops responded with gunfire to the Helmand attack. Reuters News Service reports four attackers were killed, three more captured. Earlier in the day, Afghan police say gunmen shot and killed a senior official of Afghanistan's Supreme Court, Atikullah Rawoofi, at his home near the capital. UN talks on a deal to curb climate change continue today, one day after they were scheduled to end. Negotiations stalled because rich and poor countries were unable to resolve their disagreement over who should be responsible for cutting down carbon pollution. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it's time for everyone to move beyond the past.
The United States and China, two countries long regarded as the leaders of opposing camps in these negotiations, have now found common ground on this issue. That is a historic milestone, and it should send a clear message to all of us that the roadblocks we've hit for decades can be removed from our path.
Negotiators around the world are trying to make progress in time for a key summit in Paris next year when governments hope to adopt a new global climate pact. Scientists warn that more extreme droughts, floods, and rising seas are on the way unless the emissions are reduced. Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Rome on Sunday for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on issues including the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
Israeli soldiers fired tear gas at rock-throwing Palestinians in the West Bank on Thursday. The Palestinians were angered by the death of Ziad Abu Ayan. The Palestinian cabinet minister died following a confrontation with Israeli troops. Controversy over the minister's death is among the issues that have heightened tensions between Israel and the Palestinians ahead of Secretary Kerry's meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Kerry held separate meetings with Mr. Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Jordan last month in a bid to reduce tension and breathe life into the stalled peace talks. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
The U.S. Congress has approved a massive defense policy bill. The $585 billion National Defense Authorization Act was overwhelmingly approved by the Senate Friday, a week after passing in the U.S. House of Representatives. It includes emergency funding requested by the president for military operations against Islamic jihadists in Iraq and Syria. Also authorizes funds for training separate moderate Syrian rebels and Iraqi Kurdish forces for 2 years. Russia, meantime, says there will be repercussions if Washington imposes new sanctions on Moscow over the Ukraine crisis. A deputy foreign minister today blamed anti-Russian moods in Washington for the new bill authorizing military aid to Kiev and additional sanctions against Russia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Specifically, what came out of the inefficient way the military is conducting operation against Boko Haram is extreme corruption in the system.
The newly elected presidential candidate for a major Nigerian opposition party vows to end the country's insecurity ahead of the February elections.
Our defense and security forces vigorously retaliated against this barbarous attack and forced the attackers to retreat.
Boko Haram militants attacked several villages in Cameroon. We'll have details.
I think it's very unfortunate that in the situation in which we are in, where the majority of our people have no access to health professionals, or very little access, that we can be exporting health professionals.
And plans to export Ugandan doctors abroad come under heavy criticism. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Elected presidential candidate of Nigeria's main opposition All Progressive Congress says if he wins February's general election, he will resolve the country's security failures. General Muhammadu Buhari said among the main challenges will be improving intelligence gathering, which has repeatedly been found wanting in the face of terrorist attacks. He told me earlier that the governing party is to blame for corruption, which he says has become institutionalized in Nigeria.
Corruption has virtually been institutionalized by the CDC governments in this country. And people are showing extreme concern about corruption in the country. And we have to develop a way to stop corruption. If we don't kill corruption, as some of the feature article writer said in Nigeria, corruption will kill Nigeria. And the best way to do it is to form a government. What we can do is to draw a line. Those cases that are in court will not interfere with the court proceedings. But we will encourage the courts to prosecute all those that are found to be corrupt. What we will do is to make sure that we draw a line, because we can't go on investigating everybody. Otherwise, we have nothing else to do and we may not achieve anything. If we draw a line and said, from that day we are sworn in, anybody that is responsible with the government in the treasury, federal resources or state resources or local government, there will be proper auditing according to financial instructions, and anybody found wanting will be prosecuted.
Concerns have been raised about the insecurity in parts of the country, issues of Boko Haram. You were even attacked by elements that some people claim to be Boko Haram militants. How do you think this should be resolved?
I think intelligence gathering has to be improved. I'm afraid the military of today is not the military I know or commanded. Something extremely serious has happened to the military in terms of collection of intelligence. But specifically, what came out of the inefficient way the military is conducting operation against Boko Haram is extreme corruption in the system. The National Assembly, about 3 months ago, attempted to conduct hearing when soldiers, Nigerian soldiers, were given information or interview, were being interviewed by foreign radio houses, and they were complaining of lack of weapons. So the National Assembly went and made some research and found out the trillions of Naira voted for defense expenditure over the last 3 or 4 years, and they wanted to conduct a hearing, and they were frustrated that the hearing was never conducted. So the soldiers could not perform, not because they were afraid of insurgents, but because they cannot face insurgents with inferior weapons or without ammunition. So I think it's a question of extreme corruption in the system.
Do you repose confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability to administer a free, fair, credible elections next year that you will be participating in?
I'm afraid my party, the ATC, extremely concerned about the next general election, February 2015. And there are approaches and fallback positions we are going to develop, which I'm afraid I cannot disclose now because we haven't finalized them, which will constrain INEC to conduct free, fair, and credible elections. We think that was the last thing the UBC government will allow. Free, fair, and credible elections. The examples in HT and the Ocean this year proved us right. Deploying military and police and arresting opposition members and harassing them and refusal to take election material, the constituencies in time, and arranging snatching of boxes and so on, all sorts of disgraceful things the ruling party is doing. We have to see the end of that by June 14th or February next year when series of general elections will take place.
General Muhammadu Buhari is a former Nigerian military head of state and is currently the presidential candidate for the Nigerian main opposition party, All Progressive Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, neighboring Cameroon says at least 600 suspected Boko Haram fighters have crossed Lake Chad and simultaneously attacked several villages and towns. During Friday's fighting, officials say 25 insurgents were arrested and hundreds of others drowned in the lake. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports for VOA in Yaoundé.
Cameroon says at least 600 suspected Boko Haram fighters have crossed Lake Chad and simultaneously attacked several villages and towns. During Friday's fighting, officials say 25 insurgents were arrested and hundreds of others drowned in the lake. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports for VOA in Yaoundé. Text. Cameroon's Minister of Communication says fierce fighting erupted in the villages of Nguma, Sangmi, Ardebde, Dambore, and Sawrem when government forces attempted to retake them from insurgents. Issa Chiruma Bakari said hundreds of suspected Boko Haram fighters had entered northern Cameroon from Lake Chad, which also borders Nigeria, Chad, and Niger. The militants are thought to have come from Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria. They are reported to have ransacked the Cameroonian villages and stolen livestock.
Our defense and security forces vigorously retaliated against this barbarous attack and forced the attackers to retreat. This terrorist organization is only aimed at jeopardizing peace and stability in our country.
Chiruma said Cameroon's military arrested 25 of the attackers and killed several. Hundreds of others were swallowed by the waters of Lake Chad after their boats capsized or were sunk when they tried to escape. As the fighting was going on in the five villages near Lake Chad, hundreds of other suspected Boko Haram fighters from Nigeria's Borno State attacked Cameroonian towns of Bankim, Amchide and Limani. Cameroon military spokesman Colonel Didier Bajek says government forces seized war weapons and burned 20 vehicles and an armored car belonging to the insurgents.
Cette secte est en possession d'un véritable arsenal de guerre. Elle pense qu'en multipliant des...
He says the insurgents are using heavy war weapons, thinking that when they multiply their attacks, they will weaken Cameroon's ability to fight back. 20 wounded Cameroonian soldiers were taken to the Marua Central Hospital in northern Cameroon for treatment, while the 25 suspected Boko Haram fighters were taken to an unknown destination. Cameroon says none of their soldiers was killed. The violent group has frequently carried out attacks on land over the border. It is the third time Cameroon is reporting that the attackers infiltrated through Lake Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In Uganda, plans are far advanced to export 300 highly specialized professionals to Trinidad and Tobago. The move has been criticized by health practitioners, activists, and parliamentarians in a country where 3,000 practicing doctors have to treat nearly 35 million people. Dr. Margaret Mungerera is the resident of the Uganda Medical Association. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her in Kampala, for her reaction.
Let me just say that as a health profession, of course, you know, they have a right to do that. But then looking at it from the bigger picture, I think it's very unfortunate that in the situation in which we are in, where the majority of our people have no access to health professionals or very little access, that we can be exporting health professionals at this time. It does have an impact on the quality of healthcare because we really do have an acute shortage. There is a crisis, whether it's in the public or the private sector, there is a crisis as far as the health workforce is concerned. We do have an acute shortage.
It's true that professionals are free to move, look for greener pastures. But what do you make of the government encouraging them to go away?
Well, it shouldn't be the government doing that. The government, on the other hand, should be trying to woo the professionals to stay. Because, already it's very difficult to retain health professionals or to attract them, especially in rural areas where the majority of Ugandans are. Because the majority of Ugandans are, more than 95% of Ugandans actually live in rural areas. And yet, less than 5% of the health workers are there. You know, actually, it's the reverse. More than 95% of the health workers are actually in the urban areas. But on the other hand, it's the one that's saying, you know, you go. Now, it would have been okay for them to say, you go, and it's some sort of well planned with the Ministry of Health involved. So the goal is different, but the goal is to try and see that, you know, to improve our services here in Uganda by getting health workers to acquire more skills. But that doesn't seem to be the thing, the purpose, because the Ministry of Health has not been involved. In other words, it's not a controlled migration as you'd like to see it. If I'm migrating, it should be a controlled, where you really have set up clear objectives on what are the skills, what sort of competences you want them to achieve. But this seems to be haphazardly done, and the goal is very different. It's to strengthen ties between two countries, which really is not likely to have an impact on the quality of healthcare. In Uganda here.
Given the dire need of medical professionals in the country, with Uganda having a doctor-patient ratio of 1 to 24,725, what do you think will be done? Will the government carry on with the project, or is there a way of prevailing upon government to rethink their move?
You know what? Many of us have been consulted. We came out with an outcry. It came out in the media. It's been said the Ministry of Health is not part of it, but it's not supporting it. And that should have been enough to have an impact in terms of whether this program should continue or not, or should continue in a more organized manner. But it doesn't seem to have had any impact on those who are behind this move. So I think it's likely to go on. It's a bit too late, and people are already committed themselves. We hear that the health professionals are already signed into this thing. We don't even know the conditions. One of our concerns was the conditions at the other end. What sort of conditions are there for them? What sort of work are they going to be doing? We as a health profession are very much concerned. Because sometimes people go out there and they're exploited. They go out to become nurses and they become nursing maids or something else. The most important thing is that if you look at the regional hospitals. We have 13 regional hospitals in Uganda. And each hospital is supposed to have a total of 28 specialists. Not a single regional hospital out of those 13 regional hospitals that has even 10% of the numbers that they should have of specialists. So really, the whole issue of universal health coverage and is down the drain. I mean, it's a reversal. We are going in the wrong direction.
So what do you think will happen, given that you're going to lose a lot of doctors, including the main referral hospitals, you say?
I think you know what will happen? You know, Uganda didn't achieve a single of the million government health government goals. Well, and it had been predicted to achieve them 50 years from 2015. Well, this will be 100 years after 2015.
Dr. Margaret Mungerera is the president of the Uganda Medical Association. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from the capital, Kampala. Almost 300,000 women, primarily in developing countries, died from complications related to pregnancy and childbirth in 2013. A new report blames the deaths on a lack of safe water, sanitation, and adequate hygiene. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
A paper published in the journal PLOS Medicine reports that some 38% of healthcare facilities in 54 developing countries continue to lack proper sanitation and a source of clean water, putting women who give birth there at increased risk of death. The article, written by a team of researchers from organizations including WaterAid, the World Health Organization, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, UNICEF, and the United Nations Population Fund, estimates that 289,000 would-be mothers died from unsanitary conditions, either at home or in healthcare facilities. Despite 15 years of concerted global efforts to reduce maternal mortality, the report notes it remains 14 times higher in poor countries than developed regions. Women in unsanitary and unsafe conditions face a high risk of life-threatening infections, according to Oliver Cumming, an environmental health expert at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He says the risk increases if pregnant women must walk a long distance to obtain clean water or to use a bathroom facility.
These things produce, a range of effects that we don't necessarily understand, but very clearly would bring sort of levels of stress, sort of physical and psychosocial stress, which would present a risk for the mother and for the babies.
A companion article in PLOS One describes conditions in Tanzania, where less than one-third of births occur in places with safe water and basic sanitation. Nearly 8,000 women in the East African country die each year, either while giving birth or immediately afterwards. The United Nations 8 Millennium Development Goals, which include improving maternal health and reducing child mortality, are winding down next year. To follow up on progress toward the MDGs, world leaders are working with the UN to come up with Sustainable Development Goals, which are expected to be adopted in September 2015. Cumming and his co-authors say providing clean water and sanitation should be at the top of the list of improvements in homes and healthcare facilities in developing countries. He adds that the new goals need to specifically include improved water quality and sanitation as a standalone aim, with an eye toward improving maternal and newborn health.
I think it's a terrible tragedy that women still die during childbirth as a result of the absence of these very basic things being in place, particularly within health facilities.
On Monday, 9 leading health organizations, spearheaded by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, are issuing a call to action for governments around the world to focus on better water quality, sanitation, and hygiene. The aim is to make greater progress toward improving maternal and neonatal health. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S.
UN Children's Fund says hundreds of thousands of children in conflict-ridden South Sudan are at risk as prospect for peace remain dim. UNICEF says the scale of the crisis unfolding in the world's youngest country is staggering. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
December 15th marks the first anniversary of the conflict in South Sudan, which has plunged this young country into an abyss of bloodshed, displacement, unrelenting violence, and fear. The joyous celebrations which accompanied the birth of this new nation 3 years ago have long since evaporated. The UN reports the fighting between the government and rebels that erupted 1 year ago has displaced 1.5 million South Sudanese within the country. Nearly half of them are children. UNICEF Crisis Communications Chief Sarah Crowe says these children are increasingly vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation.
What we're seeing now is a future for a generation of children in South Sudan is really being stolen by this conflict. It's driven hundreds of thousands of children from their homes, schools and communities, subjecting them to violence, malnutrition and disease. Malnutrition has doubled. The figure that we have, they're all estimates, of course, is 80,000. We continue to see children who have been subjected to all kinds of outbreaks of disease, cholera, measles.
To respond to this crisis, UNICEF has scaled up its nutrition programs, providing therapeutic care to more than 80,000 severely, acutely malnourished children. The agency and partners have run several vaccination campaigns. An estimated 700,000 children have been vaccinated against measles and 600,000 against polio. In addition, health workers have distributed vitamin A to nearly 2 million children to boost their immune systems. Crowe tells VOA, another horrible aspect of this war is the recruitment of children as soldiers. She says government and rebel forces reportedly are using some 12,000 children in various ways in the conflict.
As you know, historically in South Sudan, there has been a long, sad history of children being recruited for use in armed forces by the different armed forces over time. And, of course, it's not just soldiers. Sometimes girls are forced to be sex slaves, boys, too, forced to be porters. And this breaks down the fabric of their lives and their ability to rehabilitate.
The rainy season in South Sudan is winding down. UNICEF sees this as a window of opportunity to reach communities who have been cut off from assistance by muddy, impassable roads. UNICEF is now pre-positioning life-saving supplies at key locations in Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile, the three contested states where needs are most acute. The Children's Agency and World Food Program are delivering a range of critical services to communities in the remotest areas by air. While all this aid is crucial for survival, UNICEF says what the people of South Sudan most need is peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next on Let's Talk, hairstyles in Africa. Hairstyles in Africa is a topic we'll discuss in a new lighthearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shamari, and my guests as we explore hairstyles in Africa with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy. Have fun.
Okay. Come on. Anything where you they do, my brother, woman go there.
For sure.
I say woman go there. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there.
For sure.
She be woman go there. Share a woman they make you the
security one day.
Security one day.
Security one.
Still emphasizing, just the analyzing, hypnotizing is the hidden strength of a woman. Shy, looking at you, not killing ghosts. You go make plenty sense if you roll my boat. Don't want to pan it, pan or African baby, oh, oh, now, oh, now, oh, now, oh, now, oh, now, oh, now, the end down, oh, from the garden of Eden, don't they know be today? Beauty they brought, they throw it. Boys don't they give my role. I'm a little baby, oh, oh, we the make this club, they anything where you. Woman go there. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there.
For sure.
She be woman go there. She a woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Security one.
A woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Security one.
She be a woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Security one.
She a woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Security one.
The woman go there. It's more begin they cry. The woman be say man go so feed the ego failure. Don't underestimate my power. As for my beautiful lady, me I go love you well, well. I go to you, sorry, sorry. Make we they go. I'm gonna jam my paro. Cause without you, baby, man, go lonely. Anything where you they do, my brother, woman go there.
For sure.
I say woman go there. Party, then go ask you whether woman go there.
For sure.
She be woman go there.
She
the woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Woman
they make you the
security one.
Security one.
Security one.
Woman they make you the
security one.
Security one.
I don't care what I will buy. Cause I know we're getting high. Put your hands up in the sky. In the sky. Hey, yeah, you got me dancing a lingo. The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. Yeah, you got me dancing a lingo. The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. A lingo. A lingo. The way that you move in your window. I know we get too high. Put your hands up in the sky. In the sky. Hey, yeah, you got me dancing a lingo.
Not just okay.
The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. Yeah, you got me dancing a lingo. The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. A lingo. A lingo. The way that you move in your window.
Lose control, no, 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 no
But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my mezze boo, he dey be me like Senna for Fana. Me like how she play the bassline, it makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she dat, it makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt, touching body. Waka. But she no say, my mama no like them. Waka. I don't want this shirt touching body. Waka. But she no say, my papa no like them. Waka. Daddy come to me a bros, and when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt touching body.
Yeah, yeah,
Najee. Now you the go call me, do your left foot follow me. Oh,
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections with the audience of the Voice of America. Every passing week, I pay close attention to the headlines to understand America's foreign policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, for me, the central issue is the price of oil in the United States and in the world, and the implication it has for African-American relations, meaning the relationship between Africa and the people of that continent and the people of this United States of America. There are two or three issues that are pressing right now. Since independence and the discovery of oil in large countries like Nigeria and other countries in North Africa like Libya and Algeria, and you come south to Gabon and to Chad and several of the other African countries, and more recently Ghana, even some of the other West African countries in the Guinea Gulf, the whole question of oil for Africa, oil for development, becomes central. So when we talk about America's relations with Africa today, the changing price of oil is very good for the American motorist, because since the time of Jimmy Carter, when we have that oil embargo, Nixon, Americans have been toying with the question of price of oil. One of the legacies of Obama is the fact that he is the first president, to my knowledge, who allows the American oil to be deployed in the service of America in light of changing times and serious developments. So when we talk about the legacy of Obama with regard to Africa, one of the things most scholars and most journalists, telecasters, and observers of the scene are going to see changing price of oil. Is this going to affect American relations with Africa? Certainly the Nigerians are going to have a serious problem. We talk about transparency, we talk about corruption, we talk about all the other problems of governance in Nigeria and now Boko Haram. The changing price of oil is going to affect them politically, because you see, even the infrastructural development of Nigeria is not affected. So when we talk about American relations with Africa, American relations with Nigeria, the changing price of oil is going to have serious consequences for the election and the subsequent development for Nigerians as a people. Because Seyi Segari talked about the Green Revolution, which was needed at that time. Of course, the people didn't do anything, so it went away. And they had the money, and the money was not used effectively to develop the poor people in that country. In the north, you have poverty there, which manifests itself in the form of religious bigotry and radicalism. In the south, the people have been more stoic and subdued. But eventually, those people are going to be revolting eventually, because the price of oil goes down. They don't have money. So when you talk about America's relationship with Nigeria, this is going to be a big problem for Obama in the next 2 years. How are the Nigerians going to govern themselves? How are they going to develop new leaders who will try to govern their country so they can develop some kind of control over their own country and develop their own economy? Obama can help them. If the Nigerians get their act together and they come as a solid, united people who want to really develop their country, use their resources. The changing price of oil has implications for them because their elites dance around oil money. They have to now focus on agriculture. And that's one thing that Obama can do for them. Get them involved with American agricultural people here so that they can begin to develop agriculture in the service of the Africans, not only in Nigeria, but all over Africa. That's one of the things that should have worked out during the summit. So if we talk about Obama and Africa, one of the legacies is to deal with the central issues of life. You walk between life and death, and biology 101, zoology 101, sociology 101, all these body of knowledge can help Africa develop. Biology, because agriculture should be developed in Africa. So American policy towards Africa should focus on biology 101, which has implications. Right now, after the summit, we had the problem of Ebola, which is a consequence of diseases very much linked to the African question of life. So those people who are banking heavily on oil money, using the oil money all over the continent for their own good, must now focus their attention on how can we develop agriculture in Africa and get the people mobilized for agricultural development. The second problem that I think is going to be very much related to American relations with Africa during the next 2 years of Obama's administration is the question of government, government, government. Stupid. You have some very serious situation in Africa. With the coming of independence, Kwame Nkrumah was elected democratically. Unfortunately, they were attracted by the Russian one-party dictatorship, which is now gone. The communism is over. But at that time, one-party system was very attractive to all of those intellectuals, to the point that even Ofe Bwanyi, neighbor of Kwame Nkrumah, also went towards the one-party dictatorship. And that pattern continued to dominate all over Africa. Today, we are paying the price in Zimbabwe, where you have someone who came under one-party dictatorship and still ruling that country at age 90. When the people should have elected someone, just like George Washington, you have transition in the society. So these are serious problems all over the continent. So when you look at America's relationship with Africa, the problem of governance becomes very important. And this is very much linked to agriculture, economic development, and all these questions of being controlled by the World Bank is due to the African leadership. America can help them. The World Bank is in the United States, but the Africans have to really bargain for themselves. Ablai Watt from Senegal was pressing for the Americans and all the other countries here to develop a relationship with them. That is something that the Africans have to negotiate, whether they're from Chad, Burkina Faso, and all the other poor countries that are in the landlocked areas of Africa. Their leaders have to work out meaningful democratic rule so that their people are free politically, they are free economically, and they have to open the African markets to traders. But they have to bargain with traders. And that is one of the things Obama's legacy is going to make a difference for them. They could have negotiated this during the summit. Maybe they may come back to Washington 1 year from now, but on a new guided policy of their own to the African Union. That's the way I see America's relations with Africa. And regardless of African opinions on and attitude for the United States, the ball is on their side of the court. They have to grab it and run with the ball. And that's the way I see it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as elders in Kenya say, if you rattle a snake, you should be prepared to be bitten by it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of inexpensive, reliable energy delivery is one of the chief obstacles to growth and development in much of Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. Yet today, nearly 70% of sub-Saharan Africans lack access to electricity. This despite the fact that the region has tremendous energy resources, ranging from geothermal, solar, wind, and hydropower to significant reserves of natural gas. That is why last year, President Barack Obama announced Power Africa, a public-private initiative led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, that will significantly increase generation and distribution of power in sub-Saharan Africa. In the 16 months since its launch, Power Africa's partnerships with African governments, private investors, other donors, and developers have already begun to bring benefits to the people of Africa, said USAID's Eric Postel, assistant to the administrator for Africa. The Power Africa initiative helps governments identify the reasons why projects to improve electricity generation and distribution are lagging, and works with them to remove the obstacles as they are identified. Power Africa also works with the private sector to help companies invest in power generation and distribution. Power Africa has already helped to financially close deals that will generate more than 3,000 megawatts, which has the potential to provide power for more than 5 million African homes, service providers, and businesses, said Mr. Postel. Generating sufficient power is one part of the equation. Delivering it to those who need it is another. Only 18.3% of people living in rural communities in sub-Saharan Africa have access to electricity, compared to 55.5% of urban dwellers. That is why Power Africa launched Beyond the Grid, a competition for innovative solutions that develop, scale up, or extend the use of proven technologies for off-grid energy. Today, 600 million Africans do not have access to electricity. Hospitals cannot function optimally. Businesses cannot open and children cannot read after dark. Food rots before it makes it to market, said Mr. Postel. But it does not have to be this way. Together with our partners in the U.S. Congress, Africa, other donor nations, and private businesses, Power Africa is working to greatly increase access to reliable, cleaner energy in Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.